This is Sam Robson here with Dr. Anger Damon. Today's date is May 17th, 2016, and we're here in CDC's audio recording studio at the Roybal campus in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm interviewing Dr. Damon today about her experiences of the Ebola epidemic response that CDC has taken part in since 2014. So, Dr. Damon, thank you so much for being here with me today. Would you mind pronouncing your full name for me and tell me when and where you were born?
So, Inger Damon, I was born in 1962 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Okay. And did you grow up in Pittsburgh?
I lived there for 8 years, so my dad used to work at Westinghouse. He was in the research and development group, did solid-state physics, and they were closing up their research group there, and so he followed his supervisor to the University of Connecticut, sort of a second career midlife, so went into academics. So
okay.
Taught physics.
Oh, physics. That's one.
So I actually grew up most of my life in northeastern Connecticut in Storrs. So
Do you have a lot of memories of Pittsburgh?
I remember walking to school. Remember going camping in the Shenandoah Mountains. Pretty minimal memories of Pittsburgh. I remember my elementary school.
Okay. And what was Connecticut like?
We thought it was pretty boring because there wasn't a whole lot to do. There was one large movie theater. There are a lot of dairy farms around. And it was at that point in time, it was a university town where the buses would line up on Friday and all the kids would go home on the weekend and then come back. So it was a sleepy academic little community town. So
that's great. Who else was in your household? It was you, your dad?
So my mother and father, and I have one sister. So.
Gotcha. And what did your mother, how did she spend her time?
So mom, when we were in Pittsburgh, was basically taking care of us at home. She started to lecture again at Carnegie Mellon University. She's a chemist by background. And so she started to teach high school when we moved to Connecticut. So.
Wow. Okay. And so what kinds of things did you start getting interested in up through high school?
I played violin. Played field hockey. I liked the sciences. And I guess somewhere in high school, I decided that I wanted to be a physician. So.
Gotcha. Was that encouraged by your parents in any way? The science kind of.
I think my parents were sort of thought I was that they wanted me to be an academic, so they didn't really think that being a physician was a. So I ultimately went on. I got an MD PhD. So.
Wow. So. That's great. So, tell me about what happens after high school.
So I went to college in Amherst, Amherst College, and then went to medical school and did my MD PhD at the University of Connecticut Health Center in Farmington. Met my husband there, and then we sort of went through the medical training system. So we both did our internships and residencies in Philadelphia at the Hospital of University of Pennsylvania. Then went to Maryland, D.C. area, so I did my infectious disease training at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda.
How did you start to get interested specifically in infectious disease?
I liked problem solving. I liked puzzles, and so I think that's what attracted me to infectious disease. The other thing I was... the other field I really enjoyed was actually OBGYN, and I actually, in my clerkships, sort of in the end of medical school, trying to decide what to do, I actually did a clerkship in maternal-fetal medicine down in Philadelphia. My husband was there at that point in time, ahead of me, and it was actually... ranked both and interviewed both for internal medicine and OBGYN programs. So,
gotcha. Was there anyone up through that point, up through internship and residency, who you think had like a special influence on how you thought or your career path?
Yeah, I guess my my graduate school advisor, Mary Jane Osborne, at the University of Connecticut. Wanted to see, you know, what a woman in science who was successful, you know, and to be mentored by that type of person was important for, you know, deciding a career path and what I could do. So.
And I'm sorry, I probably missed it. What was your PhD in?
So my PhD was in what we called it biomedical sciences was the PhD degree that you got as an MD PhD, but the focus was really in microbiology. So I worked on Salmonella typhimurium.
Gotcha. Is that what you ultimately like wrote a thesis about?
Yeah. So I worked on O antigen. Synthesis. So the initial project I was assigned was one to sort of look at how this hydrophilic substance gets assembled onto the membrane of the bacteria. And ultimately, it turned into a thesis more about the regulation of one of the genes that's responsible for O antigen biosynthesis. So.
Okay. Gotcha. And so what happens after all the education, all the years of
So I guess what happened? So I really always enjoyed clinical medicine. I enjoy working with patients, but I also really enjoy sort of thinking through scientific problems and you know, asking questions. And so in thinking about careers, you know, after I finished up my infectious disease fellowship and postdoctoral work at NIH, my husband had taken a position here at CDC. And so I looked both at CDC for positions and then also interviewed for some second postdoctoral fellowship or early career track positions at with Emory University. So,
gotcha.
And I chose a job at the CDC. So,
job doing what?
So,
what was the job?
So I joined the what was then the viral exanthem and herpes virus branch as sort of as a new member of the pox virus team that was within that branch. So my boss was Joe Esposito, and the group really had gone down in size, and with the biodefense and monies, there was new positions or FTE positions, and so I filled one of those. So I was essentially staff number two in the new regrowing pox virus team.
Gotcha. So. I'm sorry, I confess ignorance here. I'm not sure what the funding, what was that?
So it's 1999, and this is when sort of the bioterrorism preparedness monies were being appropriated from Congress for CDC to get involved more in both research and planning efforts for bioterrorism preparedness. So,
okay, we're back after I had to fix the little monitor. Sorry about that. So, Dr. Damon, just tell me about some experiences in your first few years at CDC.
I guess a sense of being incredibly busy. So I actually came to CDC initially to work on monkeypox. So monkeypox was a disease that was reemerging at that point in time in the former Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of Congo. And there had been three outbreaks in that CDC had been involved in responding to in the late 90s, and this is the first time disease had been recognized since it had been studied there in the mid to late 80s by the World Health Organization. And so, you know, monkeypox caused a disease that looked quite a bit like smallpox, but it was zoonotic, so the it's a disease that occurs in animals. We don't really know the reservoir. And human disease usually came from interaction with animals. But there was also human-to-human transmission that was seen with this pox virus infection. So somewhat similar to smallpox, but dissimilar in having an animal reservoir. And so my job was going to be to come to CDC and to help develop some research projects and also help look at some of the surveillance work and work in Africa. And then at that point in time, the decision was that CDC was going to really focus intensively on the smallpox research agenda, so using live variola virus. So this is a follow-up from the Institute of Medicine report that came out in 1999. So about the future needs for live variola virus. And it sort of outlined a number of applied research activities which were considered to be of benefit for preparedness in the United States and internationally. Worked to build a team that then worked and trained to work in the biosafety level 4 laboratory, the high containment lab at CDC, and worked to grow a number of strains of variola virus from the collection to do characterizations, to then do sequencing work on that. We later sort of really helped to get the core facility here at CDC sequencing efforts together and helped to build that capacity at CDC and also helped to bring next generation sequencing technologies to the agency a little bit later. We worked then with counterpart colleagues at the United States, at the Army Infectious Disease, so USAMRID, worked on both antiviral screening, some work to look at vaccine development and less reactogenic vaccines, diagnostic development, and animal model development, whereby to sort of look at antiviral and vaccine efficacy.
Okay. By the sound of it, it sounds like when you came in, were you already kind of the head of a team?
So, no. So that's why it was sort of busy.
Okay.
So it was whatever had to be done, I did. And so gradually more people came on to work with the group. So Richard Klein, Yu Li, Joanne Patton, and then bringing expanded from there. So really grew the group from, you know, a very small group into more than, I guess, 20 people within the poxvirus team, and then became a program at some point in time. So it sort of separated from the branch and then worked more directly with the division. So did
that mean that your, you know, day-to-day kind of changed, like focusing on the lab to...
Yeah, so I think, I was in really intensively in the lab. So I was doing a series of experiments looking at how pox viruses utilize chemokine receptors. I guess, you know, September 11th, 2001 is a big date for a lot of people in terms of changing. That really amped up the research program and the need to move it forward quickly. And I think that's really about that time is where I spent less time in the lab myself and more time sort of coordinating and managing the work of others.
How did you feel about that?
By I like lab work. I think it's incredibly rewarding. It can also be incredibly frustrating at points in time. But I think when you sort of move more into the sort of the PI and less hands-on at the bench, I think it's also rewarding because of mentoring and you're thinking of projects and you're working, across a broad spectrum of activities rather than sort of simply on your own experiments.
No doubt. It's like broadening in a way. Gotcha. Was there anything you within those first few years that you know really got excited about? Any projects that either you or somebody else was working on, you were able to mentor?
I guess, I think it's sort of watching the program evolve and the successes that came from it was really rewarding. So developing new diagnostic tools when the monkeypox outbreak occurred in the United States in 2003, we were ready because we had, been through the process of developing real-time PCR assays for both orthopox viruses and smallpox and also monkeypox. And so we could take tools which we had then used and developed in what we call the Laboratory Response Network. So this is a coordinated set of state and local public health labs to implement testing for monkeypox to help support the outbreak response. I think also then from the monkeypox work was sort of the animal model development that the group has done in terms of looking at the North American prairie dog as a model of systemic pox virus disease looking at some of the antivirals which have been developed for smallpox purposes and showing in this animal model, which is fairly faithful to the timeline of how orthopox virus diseases like smallpox or monkeypox present in humans, showing that antivirals that were being evaluated were protective in this animal model. And so one of those drugs is now in the Strategic National Stockpile. So I think, feeling like we were contributing and making progress in tracking the research agenda. So.
Okay. Yeah, nice to work in an area that people are paying attention to and are funding. So did you stay in pox viruses for a while?
So I was in various leadership positions in the pox virus group, and then we merged with the rabies group in 2006. Until 2014 when I took the division director position.
Okay. Any notable memories that stick out or anybody who you worked with who sticks out between 2006 and 2014?
A couple people were, Russ Regnery, who joined the pox virus group from the Rickettsial group. Just as somebody who, with a wealth of experience and working with lots of different pathogens, was involved in setting up the first BSL-4 lab here at CDC. Someone who's just a curious man, a very thoughtful and deliberative and good scientist. Joanne Patton, who worked with me for many years to both on the bench in the lab and later in administrative positions. Elsie Simmons, who came on. There's lots of people who've really been critical to helping move the scientific work forward. So Vicki Olson now is the acting pox virus and rabies branch chief. So she came as the first postdoctoral fellow that we supported in the pox virus group. So,
gotcha. So What leads to you becoming director in 2014, and what's that like, making the transition?
So, I think being division director is, our division is, we used to be the division of our own rickettsial diseases, and so the rickettsial group left, and the bacterial special pathogens branch became part of the division. So we're now the division of high consequence pathogens and pathology. It's an incredibly diverse group of pathogens that we work on in the division. Many of them are select agents. So these are additionally regulated by the U.S. government Code of Federal Regulations. So we work on anthrax and brucellosis, leptospirosis, Burkholderia, the viral hemorrhagic fevers, pox viruses, rabies, and prion disease. The infectious disease pathology branch is also in the division, which really supports a lot of groups across the agency, and the work to support the human papillomavirus laboratory work is in our branch, as is the work on chronic fatigue syndrome. So an incredible breadth and depth of sort of scientists in the division. It's a fun place to work. There's always new things to learn. There's a really high quality of epidemiologic and laboratory work that goes on in the division. So,
can you talk a little more about, you said, you know, working with other agencies within CDC as part of NCEZID, and how that was, you know, before the Ebola epidemic?
Yeah, so I guess and because of sort of the whole bioterrorism preparedness work, which is a large focus of a number of groups in the division, we've really worked extensively across the agency. So with the bioterrorism preparedness response and preparedness branch, which is now the Division of Preparedness and Emerging Infections, with OPHPR, the Public Health Preparedness and Response Office, with the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion in terms of infection control for a number of the pathogens in the division. So that's also in NCEZID, as is Division of Preparedness and Emerging Infections. We work on surveillance issues. We've also worked with Bob Pinner's group in the center. And then I think across the HHS enterprise, you know, work with FDA in terms of regulatory review of a number of the products that are moving forward from the work in the division. Work with NIH on sort of coordinating research agendas, work with the BARDA group and HHS ASPR, so the Associate Secretary for Preparedness and Response. And really, those activities have been ongoing for the poxvirus group. You know, initiated some of those discussions, for instance, on diagnostics with FDA back in 2002. Sort of, we were one of the first groups to sort of move forward on getting regulatory approval in terms of a 510K approach on some of the diagnostics that we were developing within the poxvirus group. So,
okay, thank you. So in 2014, you become the division director, and then I think it's July, right, when you shift into the incident manager position in the EOC.
Yeah.
A lot of change in a short time.
Yeah. So I became, I became division director against my objections were that I did not want to become the division director on April 1st, but that's when my commission corps orders were on April Fool's Day. I became the division director. I said March 30th would be just fine. But so, and this was really the Ebola response in West Africa was, you know, gearing up. People from the Viral Special Pathogens branch had been, you know, already deployed to Guinea to help support that work in late March when disease was confirmed. We were involved as the division director was involved in sort of writing some of the first CDC foundation proposal to get funds that could be more easily used in the West Africa context to support the response activities in Guinea, and you know, sort of watched the optimism in the late spring that, you know, hopefully disease was on the wane, was being contained. So although disease had been identified in Guinea and then Liberia, and you could, it looked like the Liberia response was robust enough to have contained disease spread, and that there was a good response. And in Guinea, it also looked like disease cases were on the wane. Cases had not been confirmed in Sierra Leone. And I think then, as the spring moved into the summer, sort of began to get the sense as both WHO and CDC brought their people helping in the response efforts in those countries back home, it became clear that the spread of disease was far worse than had been suspected, and so I was actually on vacation in July and not doing a lot of vacating. So for a number of issues came up at that point in time, both sort of the discovery of the vials of smallpox virus or variola virus at on the NIH campus, and talking about whether the Emergency Operations Center should be set up to help with the Ebola response, really to try to get additional people in country. One of the challenges that, you know, was identified even in the spring of 2014, Pierre Roland, you know, we need more people to come and help because there just isn't the type of workforce present in these countries that had a good public health background to be effective independently, that they really did need a lot of support from both non-governmental organizations and governmental and other international community to help with the response effort. This is something that Médecins Sans Frontières had also said, that there really was the need for more people to come and assist, and that this making it clear that this is really of international importance, and it's only through curtailing the spread of disease in the countries that would the global community be protected against the potential importation of disease beyond the West African countries, which we in fact saw.
So what kinds of things did you do to try and advocate for that, for more people?
So I think by the virtue of activating the Emergency Operations Center, and so Stuart Nicol was the first incident manager in July, so I think it was activated on July 6th. It was really to, you know, develop a structure that could be more responsive and get people to the field quickly. And so by activating the Emergency Operations Center, it avails you of a number of opportunities to speed the logistics for getting people in country, to support them to get the type of equipment that they need out to the field. And then it also, there's a tremendous amount of work that happens in bringing people here, into the Atlanta area, into the center itself, just to support the people that are in the field. So,
okay.
So I became the incident manager in the end of July, July 26th. So
why?
I think so. At that point in time, we were still in what a phase three activation, but it was just getting more and more demanding, and I think Stuart really needed to be able to focus on a lot of the scientific work as opposed to some of the management work. So I came in to be the incident manager to free Stuart up to really help coordinate the science. So Stuart was the chief scientific officer for the response for many, many, many months. So.
Okay. Also, I should have asked, were you just in town on vacation in July?
I was in Colorado.
Oh, you're in Colorado.
Yes. So, yes, my husband and I had been convinced by our brother-in-law that we should, and my sister-in-law, that we should try to run the Imogene Pass run. So we were training for the Imogene Pass run. So.
Gotcha. Have you been a long-time runner?
I've done a couple of marathons.
Oh, wow.
So. About 2 2/3.
Gotcha. And then it was a different kind of running that you were in store for over the next few months.
So, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. And so I think level one activation is August 5th.
Rapidly ratcheted up both when it became clear that disease had been exported to Nigeria, and really then the mounting need to make sure that we had a robust and effective domestic response plan in place, ratcheted up to level one.
Right, level one.
Fine.
Gotcha.
Stage one.
That's right, okay. So, yeah, it's happening at the same time as that individual flew from... was it Liberia to
Lagos,
huge international city.
Right.
Now, when you learned of that, were you currently incident manager?
So that was, I think, day two of being incident, day three of being incident manager. So we were waiting for confirmation from the lab in Germany. And so when it was confirmed, we already had sort of people in country in Nigeria, so the polio team was there, and Frank Mahoney. So my husband was actually the incident manager for the polio response. So I asked Greg to call Frank. So sort of over that weekend, we pulled together sort of a minimal crew of people to go to Nigeria to help the polio group in terms of coordinating the response in Nigeria with their incident management system, which had been set up for the polio response.
Right. Did it take a while to get to that point where it was like, okay, let's use this polio team to come into Ebola, or was it pretty quick?
It was pretty quick just because there was a good, the field epidemiology training program, FETP, was really strong in Nigeria, a really good leader there. And so with the polio crew there, we were able to rapidly use them. Frank is a force and a terrific leader. And John Verdefeu also, who later then took over the work in Nigeria.
Okay. I should have asked before. Your husband, Greg, focuses on polio?
So he was, for a couple of years, yes, he was running the polio response as the incident manager, and now is actually in our center running the AMD program.
Gotcha.
So.
Okay. And yeah, that sounds like such a serendipitous connection that you told Greg to call Frank.
Well, I don't remember all that was going on, but it was just an incredibly chaotic time. There was, you know, a large number of issues going on, and it was clear that we needed something rapid in country. We needed to make sure that Nigeria was as well staffed as could be, that rapidly got information to them about disease and what could be done. I think there's was a lab in country which had been doing Lassa fever diagnostics, and so they and so that was supported by Stefan Gunter's group in Germany. So they really took on the diagnostic support in Nigeria, really just trying to figure out what it was that CDC could do to help contribute to response efforts. And so really it was communication needs to get education messages out to the community, to engender support for activities that would be going on, to help manage infection control issues, both in the hospital where the individual had been cared for and was taken to from the airport, and then trying to identify places which could be used for Ebola treatment. And so CDC assisted in all of those areas, and then also in just the response that needed to be coordinated in terms of identification of contacts and following and monitoring them.
Right. So, were you in pretty close contact with Dr. Frieden throughout?
Yes. Yeah. That would be an understatement.
That would be an understatement. Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Frieden was incredibly hands-on, whatever could be done, wanting to make sure you know, that, you know, the best individuals in country were engaged and were aware of, you know, whatever it was that CDC or the U.S. government could bring to support. He was a strong advocate for, you know, sort of rapidly ramping up whatever could be done in terms of some of the investigational antivirals or biologics, so the ZMAP compounds, vaccine work, and was a strong motivator in terms of sort of helping the U.S. government, you know, ramp up activities on many of those fronts.
Any other developments in the Nigeria response that come to mind?
Frank is probably the best person to talk about that in terms of, you know, what it was like in those first, you know, days. I remember, you know, calls where, you know, he was, you know, trying to get individuals who, you know, were contacts and had signs and symptoms of Ebola, you know, into places where they could be safely treated and isolated. You know, he'd be standing outside an ambulance, you know, trying to get, you know, somebody inside to a healthcare facility, you know, and calling us in terms of, you know, what was going on and what we could do to try to help move things forward in terms of making strategic calls to the ministry, or, you know, helping to identify people who in country would be most efficient to help manage the response in Nigeria.
Right. So, I don't want to lose track of that fact that, you know, that you're the head and you're in Atlanta, and there's this communication that has to take place between the field and in Atlanta, and having to bridge that gap.
So, yeah, so it's really, it's you want to make sure that the people in the field are empowered to make decisions, and that we in Atlanta are doing our utmost to support those efforts in country and making sure that we're communicating to them, you know, what we know from our vantage point, and then understanding from their vantage point what they're seeing on the ground and where it is that they need additional support.
Right, no doubt. So, was there, I remember the UVD made a jump to Port Harcourt at some point.
Right.
Was that a kind of a pivotal thing, or was that a
so
crazy
that
time?
Was so you know that was really it was a point in time. So we knew at that point that there were a couple of contacts who were high risk that had not been monitored for a few days. There was some concern that, you know, where had these individuals gone? Where had they eloped to? The recognition that they had and getting the information that they'd gone to Port Harcourt, essentially, and then moving, you know, another, you know, emergency response or operations center to Port Harcourt to help manage that. There was... it was a collective sigh of relief when the last contacts, you know, made it through their 21 days of monitoring, that we'd gotten through this.
Yeah,
so
absolutely. And then the other thing, I suppose, that's happening in the same time period is the two Americans from Liberia being evacuated, coming back to Emory. What was your involvement like in all of that?
So we were involved in, making sure Emory was comfortable and felt prepared to bring them in. A number of folks from DHQP went over and, helped, with mock training and, reviewing their protocols, which were in place. Reviewing the facility. We were involved in helping to set up the medevac to get them back to the U.S., the two individuals, and then trying to assess anybody else who was considered to have an at-risk exposure, trying to get people to a point where they could be monitored safely for the 21 days.
Right.
So.
Just a huge number of different relationships that you're having to maintain. Can you talk about that aspect of it?
It's a huge number of relationships, so both within the incident management structure within the agency, running IM meetings, making sure each of the task forces are staffed, understanding what the scientific needs are, thinking about, what new programs, had started off every day with a call with HHS in terms of status updates, what's going on domestically, what's going on internationally. There were briefings with the National Security Council, usually at 1 o'clock every day, an end of day brief with Dr. Frieden at, 5:30 or so every day, meetings, throughout that period of time. As the incident manager, you delegated as much as you could. One of the deputy IMs handled the calls, which were later instituted with the ambassadors of the affected countries and the at-risk countries to get them up to speed on what was going on, so that clearly their role in country was critical for helping support CDC activities on the ground, since they're responsible for the safety of everybody who comes into the country who's an American citizen. So Lascaris in Guinea was an incredibly hands-on ambassador who was incredibly effective supporting activities in country and actually strengthening activities in country. It was an incredibly effective communicator with the local people of Guinea in terms of, knowing languages and you know, learning native tongues of the country. It was really a unique individual.
I love hearing about that. Thank you. Any other individuals, especially during this early point, you know, like July, August,
So when the disaster declarations came into place in the countries, that's when our response became coordinated underneath the USAID OFDA approach, so the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. So that was also an incredible work in progress in terms of putting together the foundational document of what would the coordinated activities look like. So we would be responsible for essentially the public health response. OFDA, you know, already supported a limited number of activities, mostly in Liberia, and then also, you know, established more of a footprint in Sierra Leone and Guinea. And so leveraging whatever was already in place, and so this was also part of that going up to level one activation. What it was that CDC would add additional technical expertise to, and working through what that relationship would look like in, you know, the briefings with the National Security Council. So before the USAID, sort of the EPT program had been involved to some extent in helping with PPE distribution in some of the countries, and now this was all sort of being marshaled under the OFDA. So that was a new relationship for CDC to work with in terms of how we interacted in country, and so that was really in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea.
Right, a new relationship in what you described as a really chaotic environment.
Right. Well, it's a chaotic environment. There's, it's trying to get health messages out to a population that, in many cases, does not have, you know, a good understanding of, you know, germ theory. A lot of mysticism. You know. Belief in, you know, is this witchcraft? So really trying to get healthcare messages out that could be understood by a population which, you know, really is one that, you know, lived by oral history as opposed to, you know, written messages. And so trying to figure out how to target that. Then trying to build effective structures in country to help manage the responses, so working to develop emergency operations centers and streamlined, you know, modes of communication so that people in country could work effectively with each other. Initially, there were too few implementing partners. Then there were many people who came to the table who wanted to participate, and trying to sort of manage all of that. I'm now rambling, but
you're good. It's good. It's all good.
I think one of the most exciting things we did was really try to build additional capacity in country, in terms of trained responders who could help support work in Ebola treatment units. So, you know, in August, as the numbers were climbing exponentially, you know, MSF was clearly strained. Wanted assistance, but just had already expanded so much that they really didn't have even the additional flexibility to help support training of new people. And so we worked with MSF and with WHO to put a training program together that launched in September. And really was an intensive effort of a large number of people in the agency to put an Ebola treatment unit training together. So you know, what are the principles of how you take care of Ebola patients? What are the principles of infection control? What are the operational standards? Some experiential training in terms of, you know, dealing with cleaning up spills, and, you know, the basics of Ebola. And so this was a one-week course that was put together, and I guess by the end of 2014, over 600 individuals had gone through it and participated in the, many of them, if not all of them, participated in the response in West Africa. So really we were able to do something innovative to help support the treatment capability in country.
And we're talking, we're referring to the trainings in Anniston.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's neat. I want to go back to something you mentioned about, it sounds like early in the response there was a problem with crowding in some instances, that there were a lot of organizations that wanted to help and having to manage that?
Well, in early, there was a distinct paucity of responders.
Okay.
And so
okay.
That was when Jordan Tapero went to Liberia. I mean, part of that first month, so he went as the first sort of lead under this OFTA umbrella. It went to sort of identify what were the NGOs in country. There was somebody who was very experienced from OFTA in country who was really a fabulous counterpart. Many of these NGOs were just unwilling to take that additional risk and or just didn't feel like they had the capacity to take on some of the Ebola treatment issues. And so really trying to encourage and look for ways that could be supported. And then I guess around that time was when the decision was to move under the UNMIR structure, so the UN response, which was hopefully going to bring in much of that humanitarian assistance, so bring in, you know, World Food Program, you know, help with operations and logistics in terms of building Ebola treatment units, you know, support for health communications. The playing field became filled with many people who, in trying to sort of make sure there were a comprehensive and a cohesive plan for moving response efforts forward, I think became an ever-evolving situation as more players came to the table.
Okay, I appreciate that description. How, you know, at first there's this, as you said, paucity of people for a variety of reasons, I'm sure, and then it's the UNMIR that precipitates a lot of players in an initial probably disorganization with that.
So, well, I think it's you know, there was WHO, it initially was run by the regional offices, then Geneva was more involved, then UNMIR became, so within the U.S., it was sort of initially CDC, you know, USAID, EPT helping, DITRA, the DOD also assisting in some of the lab-based issues, then moving under an OFTA structure. So really always trying to understand, you know, what are the specific roles and responsibilities, and so wanting to make sure one of the things that we pushed for within each of the three countries was really to have an incident management system set up so that the roles and responsibilities of all these different players could be clearly defined and understood, and so there would be unified effort. But, you know, it's just, you know, the number of, you know, calls you would have where, you know, there's PPE needs and, you know, people say there's PPE in country, but there's not personal protective equipment or PPE where it needs to be. And so what's the distribution system? It was never ending. So.
Right. Can we just stick on this for a second? And could you describe just the development of how this went, managing so many different partners?
Well, I think it's, I mean, it, and so I think that's, you know, HHS had some role, the National Security Council had some role, so this is from the U.S. perspective. And I think within each of the three countries, it was, you know, who is the incident manager within the country? So in Guinea, Sakoba was identified as that person, mm-hmm. and then supporting that person so that, you know, there is, you know, a structure of, you know, who's responsible for case management, who's responsible for contact tracing, who's responsible for health communications, who's responsible for infection control, and so with and trying to make sure that, you know, meetings ran smoothly and it wasn't just, you know, 3 hours of people talking, but, you know, identifying what needed to be done, what was a status update, and how tasks were going to be assigned. I think this is something that in Liberia, so with Tolbert as the incident manager, I think there was, this process sort of evolved, I think, fairly efficiently over time. And decision making and information sharing was fairly good. Sierra Leone, the UK really supported a lot of these efforts,
Okay. Of course, in Sierra Leone, it's much different because the UK is there. NERC comes into play at some point. Because of that different organization, did you find that, you know, that organization of so many different partners fared differently than in Liberia?
I don't know that I had the greatest visibility on the organizational structure in Sierra Leone. So I think, you know, CDC initially was really there as sort of a technical advisor, and not as much in terms of, you know, providing hands-on for the overall management. And I think in many ways that was probably a strength. So CDC really focused there in Sierra Leone on a lot of the communications needs. So that's where sort of the big idea of the week sort of evolved. So trying to look at sort of, you know, the many health communication messages which were going out there and then trying to streamline it into, you know, focused messages which would change on a weekly basis. So something that was sort of fresh, keep people up to date and involved in terms of understanding Ebola and the response efforts. I think it allowed CDC to be more actively engaged in helping with contact tracing and sort of moving those efforts along, which was one of really the key components of the effectiveness of the response, was to be able to identify those people who are at risk of getting disease and rapidly getting them into isolation or treatment. And then I think in some of the initiatives, so the Western Surge, CDC had sort of key roles in helping to move some of those activities forward.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. And when I spoke with Dr. Frieden, he talked about how the difficulty with Guinea was that, well, he said that, frankly, you know, the reason they haven't, the epidemic lasted longer there was because CDC wasn't able to put as many personnel there because there's a paucity of Spanish speakers, French speakers. So what were some differences in dealing with?
I mean, it's actually, I think Guinea, it was really unique. It was a very different trajectory of the outbreak than what was seen in Sierra Leone or Liberia, where you really saw this sort of exponential growth and this then wrap it tail down. So, I think we were limited in the number of people that we could get into the field in Guinea because we don't have that many French speakers at the agency. But you tended to see sort of more, you know, the typical sort of, you know, a flare-up of cases and then it would go down, which is, you know, typically what had been seen in previous Ebola outbreaks in Congo or in Sudan or in Uganda. Guinea is also, you know, quite a bit larger than Sierra Leone and Liberia. There are multiple different sort of sub-ethnic communities as well within Guinea. So I think getting the messages out and getting it integrated in each of those societies is really important for disease control. And once I think well exemplified in Lofa County in Liberia that, in September, it really looked like disease was going down in Lofa and really weren't sure, was this a reporting issue or was disease really going down? And so trying to look at multiple sources of information, both on, case reporting, number of deaths in the community, number of individuals in, Ebola treatment units, and all of the data seemed to align to say that there really was a decrease in cases, but really trying to understand why was that. And one of the reasons really was that the community was beginning to address it on their own, that sort of the repeat efforts and really, this is of one primary one individual from WHO who really went into that community and sort of did the sit downs with the tribal leaders and community leaders to talk about disease. And as the community took ownership of it, I think we began to see that's really what led to the decrease in the number of transmission events and the number of cases.
Wow. Who is that person from WHO?
Peter Clement. No.
Gotcha. No. Okay. Well, I think I'm getting a good picture of kind of the differences in managing CDC's response in the three countries, and that's helpful. Thanks. So, I suppose on the chronology, the next thing that would happen would be a huge focus on the domestic response in the wake of Dallas, right?
Right.
Can you take me through that?
Yeah, and I guess the other thing I would say about Guinea is was a lack of communication infrastructure in Guinea really hampered the response as well. So, the limited ability to communicate easily with all of the communities, radio towers, need to be built. Internet connectivity was very poor. So as that infrastructure developed and evolved, I think that also helped with the response. It's interesting because I think also that in some ways, because the disease never achieved those epidemic proportions that were seen in Sierra and Liberia, there was more of a capability to actually do, contact tracing during the course of the response. And so I think that also sort of, even though it extended longer, the trajectory was very different.
Right. Absolutely. And actually, I'm remembering another thing that you said, which was that it's similar to some of the outbreaks that you saw before in Congo, in Uganda.
Right.
Did that lead to some greater sense of comfort in dealing with something?
When it was introduced into a new community, there was lots of fear and panic, hiding cases. As the community got more accustomed to it then and began to understand the disease and not it's witchcraft there was additionally sort of issues of distrust of government was also present in Guinea. So I can't remember the original question now.
Oh, I was just I was asking whether the similarity in cases in Guinea would led to greater.
Yeah, so I don't think.
Hold on a second, sorry.
Okay.
So October comes around. I suppose earlier than that, late September, you're hearing about a case in the United States.
Right. Yes, I was in Liberia when we were visiting just to see how things were going in Liberia when sort of the first reports of a potential case in the U.S. So
right. Okay. Now that you mentioned being in West Africa, was the trip to Liberia the first time that you had been there during the epidemic? What did you see?
So I saw, you know, the Emergency Operations Center at work. I saw Elwha Ebola Treatment Center. I saw some of the Ebola treatment centers that the U.S. military was beginning to put together at that point in time. I saw the U.S. military set up. Talked with them in terms of sort of the coordination of the U.S. military's efforts with Ebola treatment unit building in Liberia, with CDC and in-country and OFDA partnerships. So
wow. But it's not until October when the U.S. military really comes in force, correct?
Right. So this was sort of the, you know, sort of developing the planning, but they were, essentially the old Ministry of Defense site was the site right outside of Monrovia where one of the big ETU builds was going on. And so that, you know, they'd already, you know, poured the slabs, so went and saw that, so.
Okay, gotcha. So I knew that, who was I speaking with? I was speaking with someone recently about how long before October there were efforts from people in CDC to try and get that military presence going, to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think it was really, I think the modeling efforts that Martin Meltzer and others were putting together, mm-hmm. sort of looking at what would happen if the case counts continue to increase with the same, trajectory as what we were seeing. As far back as, June, July, when MSF was raising the call that there needed to be additional support, there had been inquiries to the DOD through the DOD representative that we have at CDC to see whether they would engage. And I think it was really only Frieden briefing, at the White House level, what the potential, extrapolation of case counts would be that really sort of garnered the support that the DOD should reprogram some of its funds to support the work in for ETU builds. They still were one of the things we'd hoped for as well, because the DOD really has a very good and very strong infectious disease capability in terms of their medical capabilities. We hope that they would also staff the Ebola treatment units, and that was something that they weren't willing to do. We did ultimately encourage the United States Public Health Service to take that on. So,
sure. Right. What was lost because the United States military wouldn't staff those things?
So again, I think a lot of American physicians through NGO opportunities staffed Ebola, the more classic Ebola treatment units. And then the staffing of the healthcare worker facility that was built in Monrovia, called the Monrovia Medical Unit, was staffed ultimately by United States Public Health Service personnel. And so this gave a better sort of healthcare worker to patient ratio, and had a few more technical capabilities than the classic Ebola treatment unit had. So what was lost? So I would say that the numbers perhaps we knew best in Sierra Leone, but and in Liberia perhaps more than in Guinea, but early on, especially, there were a large number of healthcare workers in country who succumbed to disease. More often than not, we believe, because of treating individuals in facilities without appropriate personal protective equipment or knowledge of the infectiousness of what they were dealing with. And so I think, again, what we saw is when you responded rapidly and could go in quickly with everything you needed, that you could rapidly curtail the size of the outbreak and the number of cases. So that was also the strategy developed in Liberia, which was known as the right strategy. Mm-hmm. So respond and
it's rapid isolation and treatment of Ebola. Sorry, I only asked because Dr. Tapro mentioned that it would have been good to get some training for military medical staff having that experience in ETUs. But I keep on circling around it. But tell me about your vantage point, especially as incident manager, through what was going on in the domestic sphere.
So when I came on in July, I think one of the things I recognized is that there was a state coordination task force, but we needed to make sure that they were more engaged across the domestic community. And so what did we need to do in terms of more frequent briefings for both the organizations that we work with, so NICHO, ASTO, CSTE, APHL, state and local health departments, what did we need to do in terms of domestic preparedness? So this was also the medical care task force in terms of infection control guidance, getting information and health communications out there, and letting people know where to find the information. So we increased the frequency of sort of the multi-state calls and partner calls, ultimately brought individuals from NACHO, CST, ASTO to sort of be embedded with us so that they could also then get communications out to their membership more frequently. And so that was done in Chris Cosmos and Harold Pietz's Steve Bodenheimer in terms of the state coordination task force. So,
okay. Do you remember any moments specifically in coordinating?
I think the most intense period was, having to go back and revise all of the infection control guidance in light of Dallas, with really imperfect knowledge about what happened there in terms of why the two healthcare workers were in fact infected. I think we learned an incredible amount there as well about, and also at Emory, in terms of medical waste. What the barriers were to, moving material to, having it taken care of, since it was considered a Category A waste. And I learned more about waste management than I ever knew before. the intensity of trying to explain again, with limited accurate knowledge about why the healthcare worker infections in Dallas occurred, and try to communicate that and then revise guidance. Essentially we, made a decision, so recrafted guidance, cross-cleared it with MSF, with WHO, and really the focus became, cover all skin, make sure people are trained, and exercised, and in donning and doffing, and all protocols. And then I think from that, I think we also sort of, that's really, a period of, a week or two where we intensively looked at what could we do to have prevented the delayed recognition of this individual as having Ebola. And so that's really what led to the guidance in terms of the movement and monitoring guidance. So identifying, so not just doing exit screening in country, which is what had been instituted to try to prevent the export to Nigeria, but additionally to do this risk assessment of individuals when they came into the United States, to then triage them into some level of risk for Ebola, and then make recommendations on, in terms of their movement, whether they could use public conveyances or whether they needed to use private conveyances. And then that ultimately then turned into the post-arrival monitoring system within the U.S. So being able to take that risk assessment and then provide that to the state and local health department where that individual would ultimately go, and have that person monitored for the remainder of their 21 days of potential at risk for infection. And sort of developing those systems and putting those recommendations in place was an incredible amount of time on, and 24/7 in terms of really working through multiple iterations of a document, moving it through HHS for review, moving it through other agencies across the U.S. government, working with Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection to get people trained. Again, the issue of, waste management of the PPE that people had to use, and just an incredible number of details that, you don't think of when you go into this. So,
no doubt.
So.
I hate this term, but any decision points specifically that you remember, either in the infection prevention guidelines or in the monitoring and maintenance, or monitoring and
movement
guidance, as incident manager.
So I think really, the changes to the movement and monitoring guidance, and really developing the post-arrival monitoring system, and then marrying that to what ultimately we turned into how we looked at domestic preparedness in terms of hospitals. So we would have, the Ebola Treatment Center. So ultimately there's 55 of those identified and certified across the United States, and sort of the strategy of, within 200 miles of where somebody resided, you would want to have one of these places. And then coordination with assessment hospitals, which would be able to, with appropriate PPE, assess patients for the possibility of Ebola, refer them if needed to an Ebola treatment center, but be able to take care of them for a short period of time, and then the frontline hospital. So that was, I think, a huge lift in terms of, policy development, and, changes to that policy over time.
So you're incident manager through March of 2015.
So I was the incident manager from the exponential shift up to the downward slope.
Right. It's an amazing perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's, the fact that we essentially, in August, were just so defeated by the numbers of what we were seeing internationally that when we put together sort of the dashboard for which we presented to the president on a weekly basis in terms of what was going on, we didn't even include contact tracing in the beginning of it because there were just so many cases. There was not the bandwidth in Liberia or Sierra Leone to do that. You know, there still was some capacity in Guinea. And it was only, you know, sort of when we got past the, you know, or bending the curve, as the phrase was, that there really was the ability to sort of allow people and there was the, you know, time to build the capacity and train people to get that capacity in place and country. And that was it really a key need in each of the it's a key factor that's required for Ebola outbreak control, just because there, you know, currently are no, you know, licensed antivirals, nor there is a licensed vaccine to use. And so you really are trying to do supportive care, rapid identification and isolation and treatment of cases so you prevent, you know, future transmission, and then identification of contacts, you know, who's at higher risk, you know, who's at lower risk, and then monitoring those individuals for the incubation period. You know, I think NIH really and CDC also contributed really to an extraordinary effort, and as did WHO, in terms of trying to move to the field, you know, protocols which would allow the evaluation of both antivirals and vaccines.
No doubt. What role did you have, if any, in STRIVE?
So I had no personal role in STRIVE other than really to supporting the development of the, initially it was a vaccine team in the medical care task force, and then it became a vaccine task force in and of itself. So it's really, you know, the work of Ann Schuchat, so, and Tom Clark initially, you know, Susan Goldstein, Jane Seward, many others sort of to move that forward.
Gotcha. So. Okay. Yeah, I've had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Schuchat and Jane Seward, and amazing individuals, like both of them, just what they did. Okay. So when I imagine, you know, my timeline of the Ebola epidemic, I start to have fewer events, I think, after October, November. So I'm wondering if you can fill me in a little bit about what it was like, what was taking place for you, what happened basically from December through March.
So I think, I mean, some of the other pivotal moments, I think, were really sort of Ron Klain as being the Ebola
czar.
Sure. Yeah. So he was really, I think, incredibly effective in terms of synthesizing and coordinating the flow of information so that it channeled to the National Security Council and the president. I don't know that there is a response which has, you know, engaged the president of the United States as closely as this one did. I don't remember when he stepped down.
We'll look it up. We'll put it in the transcript. Yeah. Did you work closely with Ron Klain?
Yeah. So.
Sure. And did you have a lot of contact with President Obama?
That translated up. Okay. But I did get to stand behind him at an event at the White House.
I've seen maybe a little video where our curator Louise Shaw said, "That's Inger." Yes. You can see her shoulder.
Yes. So.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, we did this reporting, the presidential dashboard, as we called it, in terms of showing indicators of EOC development in countries, you know, later on of, you know, contact tracing and how that was working, infection control capacity in country, ETU, development and number of individuals within ETUs to look at capacity. So, and then I think in terms of, you know, the movement and monitoring guidance, again, I think, you know, included Mali for a period of time. I think one of the, you know, another pivotal decision was when to get countries off of that list. And so I think we were very effective in terms of the Mali response, in terms of getting Mali off of the medical movement and monitoring risk assessment, and sort of put that policy together and got that approved. So I think Ron Klain was pretty instrumental in being, you know, the person who listened to what we advised and then was able to synthesize that information and get it approved.
Right. So,
whereas I think subsequently it was more difficult in other cases to bring countries off. I think because you know, there had been, you know, cross-border transmission, you know, between the three, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, there was a greater reluctance, and so.
Gotcha.
But it, again, the disease was also a you know, cross-border movement into Mali. So.
How if at all, did your position as incident manager change in the last few months when you were working?
So I think, I mean, that was really at a period when there were likely far more partners in each of the countries. So I think, managing the you know, the level of support in terms of the number of deployments in each of the countries was becoming a little bit more difficult, and especially for, you know, getting senior people into country. So that would be something to talk about with Barb Marston specifically in terms of the international task force. And I think having Ray Arthur go to Guinea was really helpful in terms of sort of helping them move forward, especially with some of the laboratory capacity issues, which had always been a concern. So, and sort of moving that forward. And Ray has, you know, extensive experience with WHO. He's known by many of the partners, so it was very effective in terms of you know, a good presence. Pierre Roland had sort of been that in the earlier days as well, in terms of being very effective in Guinea. You know, and obviously Ben Dahl and Mike Kinzer were obviously also fabulous. So.
Okay. One thing that I hoped to get to, and we have limited time left. Thank you, by the way, for talking at length about this. It's no mean feat. I appreciate it. The closeness with which NCEZID and CGH came to work, and how that relationship developed.
So the technical subject matter expertise for Ebola existed in our center, in my division, in the viral special pathogens branch. I think one of the issues that I saw early on, and was sort of why I structured the EOC as I did here, was to try to spread the subject matter expertise as best as we could. And I think we recognize that typically when we work internationally, work is facilitated by having country offices. And so CGH was really instrumental in setting up the country office system for Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. and getting people hired there. Everything takes longer than you want it to, and everything did take longer than we wanted it to. It was, even though we recognized the importance of getting in and responding quickly, it was difficult, and it was not because people didn't try, and not that people didn't work hard to do it. So CGH really took on that role of sort of building that level of capacity in country. And I think Tom Kenyon was also really instrumental in getting the African Union involved in terms of helping to provide both infection control expertise and hands on the ground in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. Again, that took longer than people wanted it to as well. Engaged with partners, so Public Health Agency of Canada ended up being a very rich source of French speakers to help in Guinea, and were very instrumental in EOC development in Guinea. So I think it was really that, trying to coordinate sort of what the capacities and platforms that CGH can bring to bear, and then building the additional subject matter expertise over time in terms of having people in country who were known, gained experience, and sort of worked with our subject matter experts.
Right.
And also, and then really the center, in terms of both healthcare quality and promotion, sort of really did the infection control, technical guidance and expertise. And then the Global Migration and Quarantine Division is also in the center. So that provided a lot of the support for exit screening at airports and working with WHO and IOM and other partners. Helping to establish, better communication across the three countries to do cross-border surveillance. And so that sort of became more effective as the response aged. So it wasn't just Ben Dahl calling and saying, I've heard this rumor of, a person who went into Mali, and we're following up and we're contacting our counterparts and, a focused, team of people that would help coordinate that, and that capacity was developed in countries. So.
Thank you.
That's how it coordinated.
Gotcha. And would you mind giving me your perspective on, what's going on currently with CDC's work in West Africa, with the Ebola-affected countries office?
So, I think that's really, knock on wood, there have been, no new cases at this point in time. And I think it's trying to understand what the core capacities are going to be in country. Have we really established a quality of laboratory-based surveillance in country and a sensibility about that? Training people in terms of really to have good public health infrastructure, working with other partners in country in terms of USAID, in terms of the health promotions activity and sort of infrastructure development. So in many ways, really sort of following up on the tenets of the global health security agenda.
So. Okay. Great. Can you just tell me a little bit about wrapping up as incident manager and transitioning back to life post incident management position?
Yeah. So yes, maybe the theme is April Fool's Day. Effectively, as of April 1, 2015, I was back in the division. So Dan Jernigan formally took over, I guess, March 26th or the 27th. So we actually, worked pretty closely sort of the last, 3 weeks, during the month of March, worked closely together. We both were in Guinea, with Dr. Frieden before my transition out. It then, you know, sort of, you know, picking up where I had left off with the division and trying to move the work of the division forward.
So as you look back over your experience with the Ebola epidemic and your leadership of CDC there, do you have any final thoughts or reflections that you'd like to share for the historical record? Or anything we haven't gotten to that you think we should explain more?
You know, it's been over a year now since sort of I left, and you know, some of my memories have dimmed, but it's really just an incredibly complex response with many partners, many other agencies involved, many other non-governmental and international organizations involved. And information and data was often limited. The quality of it was poor, and having to make decisions with limited data is not something as a scientist you want to do. But you had to, in this case, assemble the best sources of information you could find and make decisions often with what you knew was poor data. So all in all, I think it was an incredible effort. I think it's, knock on wood, it's great to see that, you know, it really looks like, the outbreak is, or the epidemic is over. We've learned some extraordinary things about persistence of virus in terms of clinical presentation and sequelae of disease. It's a sobering experience, and I think it's one where really the efforts of, you know, multiple people and multiple agencies and the coordination of efforts ultimately, resulted in control of the epidemic. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sitting here with me. It's been a pleasure, and I've learned quite a bit. So, thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Getting my PTSD now.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I get the impression that you've just been through this, looking back, a lot at this point.
Well, it was an incredibly intense experience.
Yeah, no doubt.
There's things that I wish I remembered more clearly, there's just so much going on, and I'm actually getting an honorary degree at Amherst. So this weekend.
I
actually have to sort of, you know, pull my thoughts together to like give a talk. So I'm like, so it sort of was. It's sort of useful to go back and, you know, think about, you know, what is it that, you know, I should focus on.